Good morning, everyone. I've been away for a couple of weeks at Ananda Village. I have a new microphone, so let's see if it works properly. I've been away for a couple of weeks. It doesn't seem to be working. Can you hear the ring, or am I the only one who can hear it? What do you think, Leo? Shall I just keep on and we'll see what happens? Okay, good luck. I've been away for a couple of weeks at Ananda Village helping with the filming of a movie about Ananda. It used to be called Cities of Light, but in as much as we're not cities, we're not quite sure what it's going to be called now. Something to do with light. I'll really be talking more about that tomorrow evening at our house. David will tell you details about that. And I was also at Ananda Village when two longtime Ananda members both passed away within 36 hours of each other. Quite an adventuresome time, but I'm just going to tantalize you with that. Maybe I'll make reference to it a little, we'll see. The reading that Tandava offered us today about Satan is really one of the most interesting and also one of the most important on the spiritual path. I think the plethora of New Age teachings that characterized the Bay Area and the 60s and into the 70s, when my generation of devotees was just getting onto the path, when we were dropping out of society and becoming part of this new movement, which children now study in school as history. There's all sorts of ways to tell how old you're getting. When policemen and doctors are younger than you, they say. I was stopped once driving home from Ananda Village very late at night, and the road was very bumpy, and I was the only one on it. It was about 2 in the morning, so I was changing lanes really frequently. And this policeman pulled me over, and he starts asking me questions that seem unrelated to my driving. And it took me a couple of minutes to realize that he thought I was drunk. And I looked at him, and I, as a devotee, I've been on the spiritual path since I was 18. And I said, I think the last time I had a drink was long before you were born. And I got very, very sober with him, and we sort of straightened it out. And I told him the road was bumpy and there was no one on it but me. You know, this is just reality. That's how he was seeing things. But another way we can tell is because what was our own lives becomes quaint and historical for other people. But there was a whole flow of shifting out of conventional thinking in the 60s that really redirected society a lot. And people picked up certain things that they thought were important. And one of the things that people picked up that they really didn't want to have anything to do with anymore was Satan, the idea of the devil, sin, all of those things. We were into enjoying ourselves. We were going to say that if it was pleasurable, it was also godly. Why would God not want me to have fun? That was the not entirely false reasoning, but a little too convenient reasoning that we were all using at that time. And it went on. There was one particular teacher who was enormously popular, and his fundamental teaching was, if you like it and you enjoy it, that's God's will. Wow, that is a good one, isn't it? Right? Except the problem is that the way we are made is the way we are made. It's not subject to a democratic vote. It's not subject to a discovery by young people who think they're the first ones to ever have sex. You know, every young person thinks that they've discovered it for the first time. And it's a whole big story, and they make up a whole reality about it. But we are made a certain way. Our happiness comes from certain experiences, and our unhappiness also comes from certain experiences. But it's not something that can be imposed upon us from the outside. It's not a question of being afraid to experience life. It's not a question of something is bad and something is good. And people used to stay in line because they really thought that if they offended any of these dogmas, they would burn in hell forever. That's a fairly powerful incentive to restrain your energy now, burning in hell forever. And by the same token, there was a whole way of thinking about spiritual life, which is it's all right if I deny myself and suffer now because I will have an eternity in heaven afterwards. So a few years of not so pleasurable experience is really a very small price to pay. But somehow or another, as the new age of Dwapara, which is the age of energy, began to dawn with Einstein's revelations and our own expanding awareness, we just haven't been satisfied to take other people's word for it. We really want to go from the inside out. And that's the good news. A whole lot of babies have been thrown out with the bathwater, but we're going and we're looking for them, we're finding them, we're bringing them back in, because we're trying to live authentically, as people say, honestly, and above all, sincerely, according not only to what people say we ought to do, but by what really resonates and what really brings us the twin realities that we're all seeking, which is a lessening of pain and suffering and an increase of joy. But part of what we also have to learn, and we're doing a better job of it now, is the humility to believe that merely because I think something is true, it may not necessarily be true. That we have to listen with a discriminating consciousness toward what other people say to us. But if we use our discrimination, we may also see evidence of things unseen by us in the faces and in the consciousness of those who have actually experienced them. Whether we're drawing it out of a true scripture, whether we're drawing it out of a friend who has a deeper understanding, or a great saint that we happen to be fortunate enough to be in their company. Periodically, when we have come to those holidays that are related to the life of Christ, I have naturally devoted myself more during those times to reading the Bible than I may necessarily during other times of the year. And I'm not a person who reads only the Bible, self-evidently. And I see around town sometimes people who are very devoted to Jesus who'll be sitting in a coffee shop or on a bus, and you'll see they will have a very well-worn copy of the Bible, and they're just reading the passages again and again. Every so often when I'm reading the Bible, it ceases to be just words on the page, and you really feel that through those words on the page, as Yogananda describes his own book, Whispers from Eternity, through the words on the page, you are linked to an actual consciousness. And I understand why people can read the Bible over and over, because the words cease to be words, they become a vibration of awareness, and all of a sudden we understand. This is why we can read spiritual texts, spiritual books, over and over again, and they never become tiresome for us, because each time something fresh and new comes into our awareness. Now, at the same way that we can be uplifted by putting ourselves in right relationship to uplifting ideas, all of us have experienced how we can also be drawn down when we put ourselves in too close a relationship with energies to which we are susceptible because they look attractive to us or because they resonate somewhere in our being with some vibration that we have that yet draw us in a direction that we don't want to go. I used to read the newspaper. I used to, you know, pay attention to the news because I felt somewhat obligated to, living as we do in this area where people are well informed. I thought that I needed to be informed. And then I began to notice the effect that reading the news had on me. Especially lately, the news is not particularly good. And I would read about this economic problem and that one and this political problem and that one. And as we all well know, we seem helpless in the face of all of this. I mean, I myself at least have long since understood that we're dealing with flows of consciousness and national and international karma, and I don't feel anymore that signing petitions is going to make any difference. So I would read about all this, and Swami Kriyananda made an interesting mark. He said it's sort of like gossip. It's just this massive international gossip about all these people that we don't know and what they're doing, and we have about that much influence on it. And I just realized it just made me nervous. And I just stopped reading. And I've also found that I somehow, by osmosis, I find out everything that I need to know. I mean, I just hear it somewhere, or a glance at a headline tells you as much as you need to know. But I had to be realistic about my own ability to remain calm in the face of all of that fearful information. And I didn't really find that it helped me in my chosen profession, which is to help people to draw closer to God. I can do that just as well without knowing exactly what's happening in Iran or Afghanistan or Washington, D.C. or any of those places. Now, that's a very small reality. I've sometimes heard songs on the radio, you know, of people, you know, having these anguishing experiences. There was, I don't know, it was some country western song that I heard once that was so perfectly done that the sheer hopeless despair of life was just so beautifully and exactly expressed that I could hardly stand it after I'd been listening to it. You know, it was just like I was just going to drive my car off the road. What was the point anymore? You know, we are always being influenced. I'm surprised how many times the question is asked. Really, I shouldn't be surprised. Written questions, vocal questions. How much free will do we have? And I almost always want to ask the question back, how much free will do you think you have? I remember when I was 15 years old and entered my early bohemian period, and it crossed my mind that I didn't know about secondhand stores at that time, that it was impossible for me to dress out of fashion. That anywhere, any store you went, somebody had already decided what you were going to wear, and that was the only thing that you could buy. I wasn't creative enough at that time to figure out how far out you could go from that. But I just was very annoyed that somebody somewhere was making all these decisions for me. And then I observed something even worse. This was the perfect cycle. Fashion is that which you know is ugly when you first see it, and then after a while you begin to think it's attractive. That's how fashion was once defined to me. And we went through that cycle where the women were wearing the big black shoes. Really, the really big black shoes like that. We all knew they were hideous at the beginning. We did. And then I find myself about a year later shopping with a friend, picking up a pair of really hideous black shoes, and these words came out of my mouth. These are pretty. At which point I asked myself, how much free will do I have? I mean, that's an obvious thing. It's just an obvious thing, fashion. It's not something that you have to really tune into. But we're always living in this vibration of energy. And we're always living with all these other people's thoughts. And we're always living, unless we're, you know, way up in the Himalayas. And we're always living with this projection of ideas all around us, all the time. Now, we can quantify some of it. It can be fashion and we can joke about it. It can be the news. We can comment about it. But everything that we see on this level of awareness is just a pattern that goes all the way through creation. This is one of Master's very interesting comments. Everything is organized in this world because of the way it's organized on higher realms. And what Master explains to us in this reading and in other places is that there are simply vibrations of awareness, and we are not the originators of our own consciousness. We simply are a channel for whatever vibration of consciousness we choose to tune into. One of the most interesting statements Swamiji made once, Swami Kriyananda made once, is the only difference between the worst person in the world and the greatest saint is the way they behave. In other words, there's nothing inherently different. You know, a terrible person can reform and become a wonderfully good person. And they didn't trade in their eyes and their nose and their ears and their kidneys and their lungs for a new set. They're walking around in exactly the same form. They just shifted what came through them. Because of their own experience, they decided that what I was doing wasn't good, and this is what I'm going to do. Many people who have to go through 12-step programs because of the way they get attracted to substances or experiences that are not wholesome for them. And they have to then go back and try to make amends for the things that they've done. Under those bad influences, they try to fix what happened. Because the same person, the same memories, the same individual consciousness has realized that those created bad experiences. This will create better experiences, and in the future I'll have really good experiences because I've decided to be an instrument for a different level of reality. And it's self-evident. We don't need a big philosophical or religious dogma for us to notice that some days are better than others, aren't they? Some days we just seem to tune in, and that's even how we feel it, isn't it? We seem to sort of catch the wave. the right melody comes into our mind, and then all day long, all week long, all year long even, maybe even for a decade, everything just seems to go smoothly. We're right in tune with everything that we're aspiring to be. And then something will happen. Maybe we run into a little bit of bad luck. A little bad karma hits us, or a karmic bomb goes off under our feet. And all of a sudden, a whole lot of influencers are driving at us. I don't really follow astrology at all, actually, and I know very little about it, but I know that there's a truth in it. And recently, I just had this feeling that there was like something pushing on me. Like normally my aura just kind of bounds out there, but I felt like some tight little bell had sort of built itself around my aura, and I could kind of keep it puffed out inside, but it was much more work. And I called a friend who was an astrologer, and he described the conditions, which were pretty much exactly what I was feeling. And it was very interesting, and I have to say, I say this with a little pride, sort of as a joke, I say it as a pride, that for most of the time I've been able to be aware of the fact that it's an external force trying to get into my mind and persuade me to be unhappy. If you really want to describe what Satan is, you don't have to go there with the devil and the little fork and all of that sort of stuff. What Satan is a force that is not your true nature, that is trying to persuade you that now you're justified in being unhappy. Yogananda said to one of his young disciples, a woman who'd come to him as a teenager, who was inclined to be moody. And he said to her, whenever you fall into a dark mood, Satan has a hold of you. And you know, you kind of shiver like that. Satan has a hold of you. You have this picture of this guy, you know, holding your ankle. But I think those images are actually very, very helpful. And one of my favorite phrases when I make a really stupid mistake is, the devil made me do it. You know, because the devil did make me do it. However I define that, the force in the universe that finds a resonance within me. You see, those dark forces can't touch you unless there's a little bit of you that's resonating with it. Little bit of you that just still wants to be a little angry about this, that still wants to feel self-justified over here, that still has its feelings hurt about this particular thing, that would really like to see that person get their comeuppance. You know, all these different ways. The affirmation that we were doing today, I don't know how many of you could do it with your whole hearts. I quailed a little bit. I rejoice more in the good fortune of others even than I rejoice in my own. Well, can't we just be equal in this? You know? The little piece of you wants to be good, but perhaps not that good. Really. When one of my friends complained to Swami Kriyananda about another man in the community who was very difficult to get along with, it was a fact. Swami, she wrote this letter of how awful he'd been, you know, like this, and Swami wrote back very short, he just wants to be your friend. She wrote back, I don't want him to be my friend. I don't like him. You know, but where is that going to take us? That's when Satan tells us, oh, you're justified. You're justified in closing your heart. I mean, yes, you should be very generous, but not this time. You know, this time you should cling for yourself. In the Festival of Light, there's a rhetorical question. When the poor little bird who represents our soul development is so confused, and he gets sort of proud of his own power, and he decides, what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? Well, the answer to that question is, ha, that's not wisdom. But even the devil can quote scripture, and that's another one of my favorite lines. You know, whenever it seems to me that contracting my heart and protecting myself is a good idea, I say to myself jokingly, what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? That's what Swami says in the Festival of Light. He does. That's what he says, just like that. You know that song, Lord, I am thine, I am thine, I am thine? Sometimes we sing it, Lord, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine. You know, making fun of the way we tend to lean at the time when we can laugh about it. So when that desire really comes, we won't take it so seriously. Because the problem with Satan is he convinces us it's our own idea. That's what the reading was saying to us today. If we know that it's just an outside force, as I so far have been fairly fortunate to know in this rather chaotic astrological period I'm in right now, I can feel it as coming from outside of me. But once it gets inside of you, that you don't know it's outside anymore. You think this is me. And you see, it's a great advantage to know that the negativity is not you, because then even when the good times come, you have the same just slight sense of detachment. And people tend to think of detachment as not a fully committed experience. If you're detached, people think you're not really feeling it in the same way. No, that's a great misunderstanding. If you're detached, actually, it allows you to enter fully into it. If you're not detached, in the sense that we always have an awareness that I am bigger than whatever experience I am having, that's what it means to be detached. To be detached is not to be indifferent, or not to care, or not to be uncommitted. Swami Kriyananda remarked once about himself. He said, I may look less detached than a certain individual. He said, but I'm actually more detached, and therefore I can be fearlessly committed. I can be totally committed to the project I'm working on, to the people that I love, to those that I have to help. I can be completely committed because I never make the mistake of thinking anything outside of me defines me. And what Satan gets into us and makes us think is that you must be unhappy. You have to be unhappy. You have to be angry. And then all of our, what Master calls false reasoning, just jumps in after that. Well, yes, sometimes these misunderstandings really are deep in our subconscious. You know, in our reading today, Swamiji acknowledges, yes, the subconscious plays a part, because the subconscious is where the habits of many lifetimes are stored. And if we habitually believe that certain things cause us misery, when they happen again, we just fall right into that well-worn channel. But if we can understand that we are not the creators of our consciousness, but merely the channels for it, then we can be so much more aware and so much more in command. And no, we don't have free will in the sense that we can't recreate this entire universe. It's a very interesting question. How could you possibly cut your own little experience out of the fabric of the universe? And once you start looking at interrelationships, they just go on and on and on and on and on and on, back generations and generations. The culture that you're born into was formed by karmic experiences of that cultural group that result in this exact orientation that you're born into right now. And then your own personal experiences, and they all back up through how many incarnations that you can't remember that all compound right now. Then, of course, you have planetary karma, depending on what yuga it's going through, and you're going to draw a little circle and say, I have free will? I mean, get real, you know, about this. So it's not so much a question of whether we are influenced. It's a question of being extremely conscientious about what influences we accept. And we must understand that merely because it's a strong inner impulse doesn't mean it's a healthy one. It just means that it's a familiar one. And the mere fact that something feels really familiar does not at all mean that it's taking you where you want to go. We have to always ask our question, and then the spiritual life becomes a very simple reality. How many times do you hear us pray? How many times do you pray with us over and over again? Thy will, Lord, not mine, be done. Guide us, let us be your channels. Make us an instrument of your reality. We're going to reflect some influence. And the spiritual path is just more and more consciously reflecting the divine influence. Environment is stronger than willpower, Yogananda told us. When I first heard that, I felt very rebellious against that. I remember literally saying, not stronger than my willpower. But when I moved from San Francisco, 4th and Geary, in San Francisco, to Ananda Village, to the what is now the seclusion retreat, an extremely remote, secluded piece of land, and I lived up there in the company of devotees, in a very, very simple, primitive way. We didn't even have electricity. So we were just way outside the influence of the external world, really. No television, no radio, no newspapers, nothing. And that was when I realized, oh my goodness, I am such a product of my environment, I didn't even know it. But when suddenly, when I was in a completely simple, spiritually supportive environment, which none of us have the freedom to live there, but we can put ourselves in the best that we can find, welcome to the temple on Sunday mornings, I suddenly saw how much of my life was formed by forces I'd never even noticed. And that was the beginning, the serious beginning of my spiritual life, that I cannot always control the world around me, but I can always inwardly choose, or at least attempt to choose, my own state of consciousness. How much free will do we have? We have the freedom, the masters tell us, to remember God or to not remember him, to move toward the light or move away from it, which is to say, we cannot always control the influences that come to us, but we can always control what we receive. We are a receiving station for levels of consciousness. And when we discover, and only our own experience will tell us, what vibrations of consciousness really give us what we're really seeking, which is the lessening of suffering and an increase of bliss, then no one has to make you do anything. It's that our own actions, our own experience, as Swamiji says, the spiritual path is not a walk across the desert and then suddenly getting to civilization. It's moving ever more deeply into a garden of paradise. And that garden of paradise is not the cessation of challenge, but it's the ever-increasing ability to choose our state of consciousness no matter what comes around us. And in that respect, we do. We have absolute free will. We can always be with the divine. We can always be with bliss. And no power on earth, no power in heaven, no power in creation can ever take that away from you or from me, because this is who we are. God bless you.